Okay, I think we're good. All right, everybody. This is Tyler. You're listening to the Lenny and Tyler Show. And today we have Daniel Garner of OG Rose. I got to speak with Michelle Garner a couple days ago, and together they form OG Rose, the writing duo, and they put a lot of work out on YouTube and Medium, ogrose.com. You can find a lot more there. Probably also like on Spotify and that kind of stuff. I assume that the audio goes up on
absolutely.
Those.
Yep.
I've just been so inspired by the depth and the breadth of their work, and also the community that they're helping to create here online. And like say, got to talk with Michelle the other day, got to briefly touch on some of the things that you guys are revolving around, things like belonging and givens and releases. We talked a little bit about paranoia and certainty, and how actually philosophy can be something that can actually help save us from the crippling fear that sometimes can accompany a sense of certainty. We also talked about Das Ding and the enigmatic desire of the other. And I think that we covered that so thoroughly that probably no one needs to ever talk more about it, and any philosophy in the future can just bring to that little button. That's the end of the story on Das Ding. Anyways, today I thought I'd start out with a favorite joke that Peter Rollins and Zizek like to tell. And this came to my mind, Daniel, because yesterday I was reading Plague of Fantasies by Slavoj Zizek. Mm. And came across this part where he talks about how the Hebrew people were unique in that they traded out their enjoyment of debaucherous festivals for the enjoyment of arguing over the meaning of the word of God that they had received. And so this brought to mind this joke that I bet that you've heard that Peter Rollins and Zizek have told many times. It's about these two rabbis who are always arguing over the meaning of a specific scripture. And they've been arguing their whole entire lives and can never come to an agreement. And they've even over the course of their lives switched positions and taken up the other's position, and yet they've still not reached an agreement on the meaning of it. And God's up in heaven, and he's going nuts listening to these two guys argue all the time. And he gets so fed up with it, he tells the angels, I'm going to go down there and tell them the right interpretation of this scripture. So he parts the clouds, finds the two guys sitting on a park bench arguing. He goes, you guys, you're driving me nuts. You've been arguing your whole lives about what this scripture means. You want to know what it means? I'll tell you. And in a rare moment of unity, the two rabbis turn to God and together say, what right have you to come down here and tell us what it means? You bugger off back to heaven and let us argue the thing out. And so why did I – I think that I brought that up because I think that that's an appropriate joke to tell at the beginning here. Because I think you, Daniel, are someone who has learned to enjoy the ambiguity, the uncertainty of life, and have figured out how to negate, sublate that struggle, tarry with the negative, and you figured out how to turn all that into a beautiful way of relating to your wife, your friends, your family, and all of us who get to listen in on and take in the fruit of that that tarrying. So it's my pleasure to get to meet you and get to talk with you today. Thanks for being here.
Well, Tyler, that was a beautiful introduction. It means the world. And thank you for all your kind words. Michelle had such a wonderful time speaking with you. And I salute a visual artist. That is a very difficult field. And your work is beautiful and it's difficult to do that. So well done to you. I do love that Peter Rollins story that you told. And there's a few things that come to mind with it. You know, I've been actually, because Cadell will be starting his class on the Cree with Lacan. And it's kind of interesting because I mentioned this to Todd McGowan as well. There's this question of, in what ways is it actually a good thing that we're subjects of lack, that we actually can't achieve final completion? Because kind of often when you say, oh, we're ultimately abyssal, there's some sort of lack at the center, absolute knowing, some absolute limit, that can all sound kind of hopeless or different things. Well, if in fact human being, you know, one of the things that Todd McGowan will say is like, well, if human subjectivity is actually a lack, then you actually have a solution to the problem of loss, right? Like the fact that you can never get a final object. You're one, when you hear that, you might say, oh, there's something wrong with me. I must have done something wrong if I always feel like I'm missing something. Well, once you learn that subjectivity is structured according to a lack, there's actually a freedom in that. Oh, wait, no, there's not something wrong with me. This is the structure of subjectivity. So there's actually a kind of liberation in that. The other thing I would say is that lack would seem to be the prerequisite for creativity. Right? Like if there was no lack, what would you create? It also, the other thing, because I've been writing down a lot on the benefits, quote unquote, of lack. Now, maybe Julie Ress or different people would say that's too positive, but I don't know if it's positive like a cupcake because you have to do work, right? Like if you're going to be intrinsically motivated, there's no guarantees of that. Maybe you're intrinsically motivated to be a writer and nobody writes your novels, right? Maybe everyone in your community thinks you're wasting your time. So intrinsic motivation sounds positive, but it's not so simple. I think when we're getting here, we start to, it's just like when you talk about the passion of Christ, right? Is it beautiful? Is it violent? It seems like it transcends these categories, right? And it seems when you start getting kind of deeper into these ontological quandaries, it doesn't fit into simple categories like good, bad, positive, negative, beautiful, violent. Well, it all kind of comes together. It makes it, you know, I always am fascinated by Flannery O'Connor. And for her, grace is violent. The violent bear to wear, she named one of her novels. Or in Greenleaf, the image of grace is a bull impaling someone, Miss May. And it has to be that because Miss May is so enclosed in her pride that the only way grace reaches her in the horns of a bull hug her is through a kind of violence. So violence actually is used as a form of salvation when people are so lost in their pride, right? But on the flip side, you have Dante and his beatific vision that's pulling him up beyond this loft of my wings failed this lofty fantasy. So you start seeing where categories of good and bad kind of shatter. And I actually think when we talk about lack, you see a very similar thing. That you can't simply talk about final resting place or no resting place. It's a kind of bothness. When you are, as you know, as an artist, when you are painting, like you are in the act of painting, can we say that you've arrived or that you're in the process? It doesn't really work, right? Like you're doing, you're kind of resonating with the act that you're supposed to do. So there's a kind of arrival, but then by definition, you haven't finished the painting. So there's a non-arrival as well. And I think as well, the phenomenology of the artist is the phenomenology as in a real analysis of the creative act itself. Can be kind of helpful to think about lack because lack puts you in a perpetual state of a creative life, like the Nietzschean child, where you are creating, where you're kind of going forth. And the Peter Rollins story is interesting to me because basically it's kind of saying like, even God should not stop the creative act. Even God should not stop in and stop the discourse or the conversation or the movement that is the life. It's also very interesting, and then I'll give it back to you, with that kind of thinking of making some sort of creative process central, which is different. I don't think, you know, there's sometimes people will say stuff like the journey is more important than the end. I think that's kind of getting at it, but even that can be a little dangerous. It's kind of like the journey is the end, which is weird because it's not saying there is no end. It's like in the act itself. Something does actually be generated. When the guys are discussing the law, it's not anything goes. You actually do have to make arguments in the discussion. There is a kind of ground there, but it's a ground that's moving at the same time. It's almost like the great, you know how in the airport, they have those things, it's like a conveyor, but no, an escalator in the ground and it kind of pulls you along. It's almost more like that than it is some kind of firm grounding. And then also that moving ground could be bad because you're like, oh crap, I left my luggage. I want to go back. Well, now you're having to fight against it. So it's not good or bad, but it's kind of moving. And it's almost like what you're seeing there is that's the necessity of this kind of moving thing, that it's not just all relative, but it's also not solid. And it's trying to, you know, metaphorically, I've thought about it as surfing. Like when you're on a surfboard, do you have a solid footing, like some transcendental ground? Kind of. You're more so transcendental balancing or something, and then the wave is gone, and you also had to have your timing in different things. And what I think you see in the Rollins story is something quite similar to that, this keeping the movement alive, because that movement is the life. When something stops, it stopped moving. I'll also note, and the point I was going to make, And Simone and Malcolm, the Collins, were making this point in the book where they're saying, actually, by having in Judaism a kind of idea that not even God can overturn the discourse, you don't have to worry about extremism or some guy walking in and telling you what God told them to do, and now everyone has to listen. Because God can't tell someone something different than the church. You don't have to worry about that kind of like prophet or radical person coming in that's telling everyone. It's kind of like interesting as a social technology. It works against cultism. Or what you've seen in like American Pentecostalism, right? Where you had this kind of all these kind of people coming in and said, God told me to do X, Y, and Z, and then everyone has to change what they're doing. Well, in Judaism, that's not possible, because not even God is above the law. Like, not even God is actually above the discourse. So it's interesting to see how in this kind of idea of some sort of central lack, ergo movement, that actually helps us be more creative. It helps us be more intrinsically motivated. It helps us keep moving. And then from a socio-political standpoint, it actually may even defend us from people coming in and sort of pulling the community apart, because the community is constituted by that dialogue. And nobody can come in and say God told them a secret that ends the dialogue, because the dialogue is actually more authoritative. So there's actually a sociological protection in that as well. So I do particularly appreciate that story.
Oh, man, that's great. Oh, so much good stuff in that. Thanks so much. And gosh, it kind of brings to mind, I mean, for me, I mentioned this in the email that I sent to you. Of course, Mari Rudy has been kind of like my teacher of all things Lacan, kind of, apart from Peter Rollins. But really, I've sat with the work of Mari Rudy, and I think that her work, it seemed like what started to arise from her work to me was, especially in understanding like the mirror stage, it almost, the whole breadth of her work, or the way that she describes Lacan's work, seems to me to be almost this movement that mirrors almost perhaps even the Hebrew people, which is fall, which has to do with like mirror stage and the know of the Father and this dropping into lack. But then that lack being a place from which one can perceive a call. So kind of like going out into the wilderness. And then the struggle to remain faithful to whatever that call is in the midst of a world around the Jewish people, but also for us, that is constantly trying to co-opt our desire and get us to abandon the vocation, the inner other that seems to be at work within us. So anyways, I love everything that you said there.
Well, I'll just comment, to interrupt you. I mean, what you're saying on idolatry is I have a very good friend, Matthew Stanley, who makes the point that you see in the back of psychoanalysis this real concern of a kind of idolatry, and that the Jewish roots in Freud, Lacan, and psychoanalysis are very, very strong. And there is a way to look at it, is there is something about subjectivity that seeks an idol. It cannot resist looking for an idol. Because if you say the object of desire, it's kind of an idol, right? I mean, you're looking for this thing to make your life better. It solves all your problems. Well, what's an idol? This golden calf will make your wishes come true and everything. So the line between idol and object of desire is very small. But here's the problem. What do you do if subjectivity is structured for idolatry? Like, it seems naturally structured for idolatry because it's naturally structured to avoid lack, to avoid the real, right? Like, once you accept lack, you're basically saying, There is no idol. You can't have idolatry. Well, it's like, well, if the opposite of idolatry is that, maybe I'll do the idolatry thing, right? And that's where understanding the positives of lack and different things can be very important.
Yeah, because otherwise, and this has been the struggle maybe in reading Mari's work and stuff, is like, man, it feels like it's so close to falling right into nihilism of just like, okay, this lack is with me. Nothing in the world is going to fulfill it. I don't know, that nihilism has always, in working with all this stuff, has always been right there with it. And at times I've gone, the hell with all this stuff. I'm going to just, you know, go back to the safe givens that I had. Yeah. And belong there again.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, it is very difficult. Like, if you're saying that there is a fundamental lack in the nature of being, well, that sure as heck sounds like nihilism. And that's why I think this argument, like I'm trying to emphasize on the positives of lack, like how does that actually generate life in a way? Yeah. Like if you have, and this is where too, I think we have to think of lack in terms of what makes possible relation. And then that makes possible geometry. So let me describe what I mean by that. Like if we're just talking like, and this would be like the Leibniz debate with Descartes. If we're just talking a point like apple, and you say the apple has a fundamental lack, that means it will never be an apple. Well, the apple is then kind of stuck in this ever Ouroboros snake eating its own tail, right? But if I instead say, no, let's think geometrically. Actually, the apple is in the kitchen and it's always relating to the kitchen. Oh, well, even then, if the apple to itself has a fundamental lack, that actually then is an openness to the situation that it is located in, right? And so likewise, if human beings have a fundamental lack, well, that lack is also another word for the openness that makes you open to the other, the I other, the movement of self-consciousness to reason in Hegel, so that you get the basis of community. And like Trey, you know, Telosbaum will really emphasize that. From one side, the ontology of lack is a very nihilistic doctrine, but from another side, it's precisely the opening to the other that then becomes a basis of community. But then for the community to thrive, you have to have all the subjects in that community not identify with an object of desire. And this is the trick. Like, there's a bunch of stages here because you have, okay, there's an identification of lack. But then actually, in a way, if you're saying there's no, the object of desire will never actually fulfill you. Okay, well then, what if objects don't exist though? What if there are only situations? Then actually the negation sublation of realizing there are no, that the object of desire won't fulfill you is not a kind of nihilism, but in actually opening up to, wait a minute, maybe reality is not what we thought it is. Maybe reality is not fundamentally a collection of objects. Maybe like what creates the harmony of reality is relations and geometrical situations. A way to explain this, who I think is the best at explaining this, is Owen Barfield. He wrote a book called Saving the Appearances, and I think his book is really, really important. He makes the following point. He asks, is there such thing as a rainbow? And you would say, yeah. And he's like, but is a rainbow an illusion? You would say no, because it's not just me who can see it. Other people can see it too, if they're in the right places, right? So if you have person, raindrop, right distance, sunlight, you get a rainbow, right? And it's not a hallucination, but there's also, the rainbow is fundamentally relational. It requires the relation of the sun, the rain, and the subject, and then a rainbow appears. Yeah. And to cut to the chase, because a lot more can be said, what Owen Barfield wants to say is he's like, all of reality is actually like that rainbow. And it's not merely subjective illusion, because the rainbow is there. You can't reduce it to subjectivity. But we also know from like the physical design of, it's like Wolfgang Smith, right? We know that like there are quantums and atoms that because of human subjectivity, it's not that there's just human subjectivity, but there's some unavoidable relation of the human subject with the world that then impacts how the world is conditioned that works back on a feedback loop, right? So what you see is that relations are ontological, and that would get you into Whitehead and Bergson and maybe even Plongier and different things. So to me, what ends up happening is in order to avoid, say, Lacan becoming nihilism, you have to see Lacan and the, and I'm not saying that has to be nihilism, but it tends to kind of go in that direction. You have to see the loss of the object of desire as a negation sublation to ontological relation, where it actually means that what there is concretely is relation. And if that's the case, then the question is, how does the human, what does it mean to optimize or be fitting or make the most with our relations with the world, with our participation in the world? Another way to view that, the name of the game then becomes not getting something or seeking something, but conditioning oneself for different qualitative experience or the ability to actually be present with other people to a different caliber, like a Holy Spirit sort of thing, and to think about like, how does one share? And, you know, people talk about flow states, the creative act of a Berjayev or different things. Like, what would it mean? Instead of then seeking objects, what you're doing is seeking to condition yourself, like going to a gym, to participate in ontological relations and to share them with other people. And then there becomes this emphasis on community. But that's also going to require the other people not to be seeking objects of desire in that community, to also be calibrated and conditioned for the ontological relations to share in it. So I do think, and then I'll give it back to you, I definitely think in order to keep Lacan from going into nihilism, a thinking of relation as ontological, which, by the way, is not a crazy notion. There's actually lots of evidence that this is the case. If you follow a Wolfgang Smith with vertical causation, if you follow things like observer effect, if you just follow the fact that, for example, when you're in a room and somebody's upset with you, do you feel it even if they don't say anything? Like, right. Do you have empathetic experiences of people? You actually see lots of qualia and phenomenon that suggest that relations are very real, that there is something very tangible in it. So the deconstruction of the object can simply be the negation sublation of a focusing on the relation and what would it mean to do those relations well.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of easy to see from there where somebody like Trey and I think maybe yourself then goes into thinking of all of this as a communal ontology.
Sure.
And then the Trinity being perhaps the grain of all reality. And I have to say, like, it does, like, just from lived experience, when I think of the Trinity, I think of, well, if that is the case, then that would mean that everything is this relation of giving and receiving, but never grasping.
Yes.
After things. And I have to say that my life goes a lot better when I'm kind of setting my eyes and my heart on trying to be toward the world in that way. There's something to all of that.
Well, it's very tricky because it's like Michelle's bird example in the sense of the name of the game is not to cling to the feet of the bird, but it's also not just to let the bird go. You have to have the bird like sit on your hand like a pen, right? So there is a sense in which you've grasped it, and yet you have it, but you haven't grasped it. That seems to be where humans are optimal. And is it not the same in marriage and relationships? There's you have the person, but you're not grasping the person in a way that you're keeping them from developing and growing. Because here's the trick. Owen Barfield warns the following. He says, if you treat things as things, that's idolatry. Like, if you say that bookcase exists independent of relations, that's actually idolatry because you're saying the bookcase is its own grounding, is its own substantive being. That's an idol. An idol doesn't need God. It can be its own ground. It doesn't need relation. So likewise, the issue is in a marriage context, when you don't let the person, like, you're treating them as their own ground if you think you can clutch them. If you say, I can clutch you, then you're saying there's a thing there that you can entirely clutch. But if you say, no, I can have you in my presence, if we just go with that language for now, I can have you, but I can't clutch you, that means you can honor the relation of which is alive and developing and changing, but not grasp. So the key is it's not saying that there is no having in the sense of honoring. The key is the disposition. The horizon, how you're toward it. There's nothing wrong with, say, seeking to write a novel or seeking to, say, run a venue or something. One has to pay the bills. The issue is grasping it and then finding your identity or value in the thing. That's the difference. And so what does it mean? To me, this is the age of learning to hold like this. It's like Michelle's metaphor with the bird. That's having but not grasping. Where it's in your hand, but you're not closing your fingers. This is the trick. And it's very difficult, but it's also you can kind of feel it when you're doing it wrong. I think you mentioned it, right? When you're trying to grasp things, when you're overinvesting, what do you feel? Nihilistic, you don't feel as good. But when you're finding that conditioning, that condition, that balance, you can actually feel it. So it's not something that there's no indications when it's happening or not, but also just identifying that's what you need to do can help you then train yourself like going to the gym to get better at it. Because there is a conditioning element to this. You have to condition yourself to hold the pen like this and to experience those conditions of reality. Because as you condition, the conditions of reality change, which then changes the experience of reality that then works on your conditioning back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I have so many different things written down here that, you know, we haven't even touched at all yet on it. Like, I kind of would like to come back to all this stuff because I think we're kind of starting to, you know, zero in on Dosting and the enigmatic desire together and that kind of stuff. And well, maybe let's talk about this real quick. One of the reasons I recently reached out to Michelle was that you guys were talking about, you were kind of talking about Dosting and the real, and more as I study, you know, Mari Rudy or Zizek or whoever, it seems like, okay, that's the area that these guys are really interested in. Mm-hmm. And a friend recently texted me and said, hey, explain to me, you know, that lack thing again by Lacan. And, this was after a couple weeks of being in one of those frustrated states of like, the hell with all this crap, I'm setting it aside, I might burn all these books. And then my friend texted me, oh, explain lack again to me again, you know? And, so I go through contingent and constitutive lack and that kind of stuff. And just in a text, you know, try to, it's like all that came bubbling back up. And then this desire for Lacanian theory got reprimed. But what I said to him in the last kind of text that I said to him was, one of my favorite things about this Lacanian theory is that it emphasizes this idea that there is always this dimension within the other and within ourselves that can never be fully symbolized and closed in, that there is always the real that bubbles up and it is basically what makes each of us idiosyncratic. It becomes our best and our it becomes our best quality and our most annoying quality if we're not careful with that. But that understanding that each person has that dimension to them and that you have that dimension in yourself, just understanding that I think helps us to be more loving and grace-filled people to other people and to ourselves, that the way that you and I get enjoyment or jouissance or whatever we want to call it in life is maybe like the two rabbis who like to sit around and talk about this kind of crap versus, you know, somebody who loves to go out and race motorcycles and shoot guns and that kind of thing. And just realizing that, look, everyone has to get their jouissance, has to get their rocks off in some way. I like that part of all of this. And it feels like you guys were starting to touch on that in some of your recent talks.
I think that's wonderful. And there are some times where I think the terms lack, real, and Dosting are almost like the persons of the Trinity in the sense that they are all description. They're other names of God, and yet you can't reduce the Holy Spirit to Jesus. And yet in another sense, Jesus is the Holy Spirit, right? So there's this weird way in which the Trinity is irreducible, distinct, and yet inseparable. And again, if we follow the communal ontology model or we see relations or ontology, that actually describes all phenomenon. Like you have the ship of thesis or at what point does the bookcase, if you keep taking it apart, at what point does it cease to be a bookcase? Well, so is there such thing as a bookcase or Zeno's paradoxes that Bergson touches on? There actually are countless logical paradoxes that don't actually seem resolvable unless geometry is just as real, like is fundamental reality, not algebra, to go to the great Leibniz and Descartes debate. Like another way to put this is a lot of times there's this like mathematical Platonism, right? That numbers are real, like 2, 4, 3, like their deepest reality. Leibniz says, no, there is no, what is Platonic is geometry. Geometry is deepest reality because there is only relations. There are only what he calls situations. And in fact, he wanted to basically, as Anthony Morley writes on so beautifully, replace metaphysics with metageometry because he's like, all we ever talk about is geometry. And so likewise, there's some sort of geometric situation that requires the distinctions between
real lack and Das Ding, but they also seem to have a kind of participation in one another, right? So, for example, the real, as Cadell talks about, seems to be when whatever thwarts your desire, right? If you want X and then you miss the taxi and the real comes out, which is you're not going to have it. Or the real is when you lose electricity for a bit, right? It's that. And then in the breaking of reality, you know, Zizek in his conversations with Glenn Dial, I believe, he talks about how the real in Lacan is what eats reality. It's, you know, reality is your kind of ideas of how the world is. You're like, oh, I'm going to get to the airport at 8. The real is when you don't, right? You find that there actually is a difference between object and subject. That the world does actually, this is the funny thing, the real actually proves the world is there. It's like the proof of the external world because it's the brakes. You know, it's the brakes. In order to have a break, there has to be something there breaking, right? And so the real is kind of the proof of the external world. But the funny thing is, the world can kind of only prove its existence in the moment that breaks your relation to it, because what you thought was the case is not the case. Well, there has to be something there that's keeping it from being the case. So the real is that, which then the lack is the going, okay, wait a minute. The world is the thing that can kind of break my desires. I'm part of the world. Well, then there must be something also in me that has this capacity to kind of break desires or to kind of break what one thinks is going to be the case or not. And you start talking about lack. And then Das Ding seems to be like another thing that I think is so important with Das Ding is you could argue there is like phenomenological proof of Das Ding, which is like a Boothby was saying, you're walking through the forest and someone unexpected comes up on you. And you go, oh my gosh, there's somebody there. And there's a kind of consciousness that you cannot access. There's this thing that you cannot access that you know is there. And a way to look at that is Das Ding is an experience of lack that is external from you. And yet most things that are external, you can experience as objects, like a tree, like a bookcase. Das Ding is a kind of experience of an external subjectivity. It is that then is not located as a thing in reality, but is somehow there in reality because you are experiencing it in the subjectivity of the other. And so that then suggests that there's something under or in reality that is always beyond symbolization or systemization. And you've had these experiences, but then the person in the woods walks by you or you find out there's nothing wrong and the experience of Das Ding is gone. So it's almost like, you know, the wind coming with how can I enter my mother's womb again in the gospel, right? There's it comes and it goes and it comes and it goes. Likewise, the real, it comes you to get to the airport late and it goes. It comes and it goes. And likewise, this feeling of lack, it comes and it goes and it comes and it goes. So there's this kind of mysterious quality that is behind reality that can always kind of break through at any given moment. And then the issue becomes, then for me, the question becomes, okay, what is possible and are the quote unquote benefits of there being this unsystemizable, unsymbolizable phenomenon, lack, real, Das Ding, that is always lurking in reality? Well, one, it means there's always the possibility of mystery, which means there's always the possibility of something to live for because there's something you don't know. Therefore, there's a source of motivation. There's a Peter Kreeft once said that heaven will never be boring because it's full of people and people are infinitely interesting, right? You never know what's going to come out of a person. Lehman Pascal was talking about enjoying the subconscious minds, enjoying the kind of the unknown that is the other. Well, because of that, there's always creative possibility or things that can happen in relations that you cannot expect. And so as we kind of talked about before, if Das Ding is this part of reality that can never be quantified, well, that means there's always going to be a limit to how much of a final victory boredom can have. Like if everything in reality could be captured, then there would be no limits on boredom. There'd be no limits on emptiness. There'd be no limits on kind of finishing everything off, really. So in a funny way, one of the things that I guess I would just highlight is that though Das Ding has this kind of negativity to it, because it is a negativity, it at the same time sets limits on boredom. Or it sets limits on what can be known, and thus there's always something else to do. So there's a positive side to the Das Ding and the real and the lack, in that it sets limits on what can be quantified. And quantification can be what leads to a loss of qualification, quality, or you could even say qualitation, I've started to say, which means that there's always higher qualitation to occur because of those limits set. So to me, and that then gets into what I call the absolute choice, where one has to decide if this ultimate negativity or Das Ding of reality is apophatic, kind of like the apophatic God, therefore an infinite source of kind of beauty, creativity, truth, goodness, and beauty, possibility, if one goes through the purgatory, like in a Cardinal Newman sense, to be able to experience it, because it's like taking a bath, like Cardinal Newman says, so that you're not dirty. Likewise, when you encounter Das Ding, you suffer all this anxiety and worry when you come on the other person. But if you can work through that, well, now you have the possibility of a relationship, right? So likewise in Christianity, if you can get through purgatory and say Dante, now you can have the experience of the Paradiso, but you have to go through that work. Likewise, the Das Ding presents a sort of challenge that if one can get through, they can make the apathetic choice to see it as actually the grounds of this infinite creativity. But then on the flip side, you could choose just to say it's evidence of an ultimate nihilism, an ultimate self-effacement. And to me, that's where the Das Ding presents a choice. And then we have to make the choice and condition ourselves accordingly.
Okay, so once again, the recording software that I used for this failed me a little bit. Little experience of the reel breaking through and disrupting things. But we'll pick right back up pretty much right where we left off, just continuing to talk about Das Ding. Record again.
Okay. Bam. Ah, the joys. It's good to see you again, Tyler.
Yes. It's been, what has it been? Maybe 3 hours or so?
Yeah, the harmonica went on for a bit. So, you know, I just started jamming. So here we are now.
Oh, man. Perfect. Yeah, I got to listen to everything that you said about Das Ding and beautiful. What I was starting to try to say there. Was how it was funny how so much of what you were saying is what I actually have written down on this little note.
Nice. And
partly because I've been, and I wrote it down in anticipation of this conversation of, you know, thinking about Boothby and the other in myself and the other in the other. And yeah, gosh, when I hear some of that, it's like, damn, that sounds real close to Holy Spirit and exactly that point that you brought up of, where Jesus is talking to Nicodemus and this, you know, mysterious being born of the Spirit and comparing that to the wind, it's like, wait a minute, that feel like that we don't know where it's coming from and we don't really know where it's going. But there's like this interesting trust in that I even feel, you know, lately in conversation, I've been trying to lean more into understanding that perhaps the real or the Das Ding within me or whatever it is will find its way through no matter what. Mm. And that whatever my imaginary and kind of my polished imaginary and symbolic that, you know, I'm thinking of talking with Daniel Garner of O.G. Rose and, oh man, I gotta nail this Peter Rollins joke and all of that. Well, which I think I kind of did, but,
you did.
but very easily the real can show up and all of a sudden your voice cracks, you forget your play, you know, your train of thought, all of that kind of stuff. That's and that to me is also, it ties into, that's the place of interest that like psychoanalysis takes of with the slip of the tongue, the hesitation, all of that kind of stuff that I like. But at the same time, it is kind of like, gosh, that sure seems like the like it might be another way of describing the phenomena that is maybe always been described or is more thoroughly fleshed out when Jesus is talking about the Holy Spirit.
Absolutely. Well, a few things that also should just be noted. There is a tradition or some thinkers in Christianity that would say that heaven is the experience of God if you like God. Hell is the experience of God if you hate God, actually. That in Dante, what's critical is the very tortures of hell Like when the papers are coming down on the beach and they're like buried in the sand, like that's actually grace trying to reach people who don't want it. And so it's actually a torture to them. And so likewise, like if you love God, then the experience of God is heaven. But if you hate God, it's hell, right? Now, the reason why that's important is because it would suggest that it's an orientation, a relation of us as subjects with them, if we want to say the X variable or the God or the mystery, that then changes what it is to us. And so it's not that it's a different substance, but it is a substance that unveils itself differently relative to the conditioning of the subject relating to it. And that's where you have like where heaven, you know, when you have some Christian mythology where heaven's up here and hell's down there, well, then there can be that metaphorically doesn't match on as well. But in Dante, you always have this weird thing where at the top of the Paradiso, when you look down, all levels of reality are on the same horizontal sphere. It's a hierarchy on the way up, but from the top, it's actually all a circle and circle, and it all kind of goes together, right? So it's all linked, and it's all different experiences. Now, that's not to say that God is hell. It's to say that a relation with God then impacts these things. So when we look at Das Ding, the characteristics of Das Ding absolutely align with this kind of mystery or sacred romance that people talk about. Or, you know, it's really interesting. You can take The Weight of Glory of C.S. Lewis. He is absolutely sounding like Lacan all throughout The Weight of Glory, where he makes the argument of desire, right? He says there, you know, that your entire life, you've kind of wanted something that's transcendent of you. There's nothing in reality that doesn't have an object that meets the desire. Therefore, there's reason to think that this transcendent thing exists. Now, the power of Lewis's argument is kind of lost on people. You actually then require all of Lacan and psychoanalysis if you want to explain that or the implications of that. But even the explanation has to leave open the possibility of there actually being a theological possibility in that, right? But then it's based on your choice, what you choose of it. Another thing that I think can help with understanding why exactly psychoanalysis seems to often sound very Christian or have a lot of Christian sort of principles is we actually, I think, don't always understand the structure of the Bible. And let me explain what I mean by that is we tend to go Torah, gospel as Christians, right? And the gospel equals, you know, Matthew, John, Luke, Mark, and you combine it with Paul, Romans and Corinthians and different things. I would submit that the gospel between Jesus and Paul is basically an entirely different testament. If you say the Torah is the first testament, the gospel is the second testament, the third testament is actually Paul. And let's look at what Paul is doing. What is Paul doing? Paul, especially once you get after Acts, like Acts is very like a narrative, but once you get into Corinthians or Galatians or whatever, what does Paul spend most of the time doing? He is responding to live situations that Jesus never directly spoke on that he has to somehow match with Judaism because Christianity doesn't erase Judaism. It fits in with Judaism as N.T. Wright and different people talk on. But it also changes some things. And so what would Jesus do in these situations that Jesus never spoke about? And he's trying to elucidate. A lot of people read Paul's letters and treat them as basically the same as Leviticus. Oh, here's some laws and dogma we have to put on. No. What we see in Paul is exactly what the Jews are doing in the Peter Rollins story, this kind of discourse of trying to live figure out should Christians eat this bread on the altar in Corinth? I mean, it's to another God, but because it's like that's an example I always use because it's so clear. Like they're going, hey, Paul, this bread that the pagans have put on the altar in honor of the pagan God, can we eat that? Because if you say we can't, aren't you kind of saying that God has power? But then again, if we eat it, are we worshiping that God? What should we do? And Paul comes down with this very interesting position. He says, well, if the pagans are around, don't eat it because they'll think you're worshiping their God. But if you're alone, of course, eat it because there's no God other than God, right? So what you see this praxis and this kind of navigation. But then Paul is also in Romans elucidating, bringing out the implications of, okay, if Jesus was the fulfillment of the law, how do we fit that with doctrines of justification, election, and so on and so forth, right? Well, but after Paul, what you then have is a perpetual continual conversation about speaking about what does it mean to be Christian faced with a lot of stuff that no one ever faced before. Here's the thing. What Paul should teach us is not dogma, but methodology. Like what Paul shows you is a methodology of how to think Christian, not to merely be Christian. Like Jesus never teaches us on nuclear weapons. Jesus never teaches us on AI, but you could argue that there are principles that would help you think through that, right? Well, likewise, that's what Paul is doing. Well, psychoanalysis can be seen as a continuation of a discourse to try to determine what it means that humans are fallen and what is the characteristics and structures of subjectivity given that fallenness or given that fundamental incompleteness. And then if Das Ding is kind of two sides of what makes possible this eternal mystery, but also hell, then you start to get into why exactly the fall enables a greater like Eden in New Jerusalem, right? You start seeing how the fall is actually part of a redemptive narrative if one conditions themselves relative to it, right? Because there's always that question of, well, if God knew that man was going to fall, why did he let him fall? And you can get into the mythology of that. You can say, well, there was no other option. There was free will, blah, blah, blah. But then you also have to make an argument then, why is it that freedom is a good? Like Alyosha is asking Ivan, why is it better? Well, because freedom makes possible an Eden that's greater than an Eden without freedom that's then realized in New Jerusalem, right? You can talk about all that. Well, that would require then the structures of subjectivity like Lacan is talking about. And then you almost need like a Paulian figure or different teachers to elucidate the structures of that subjectivity so we can better think through it. So what you can, for me, really kind of see is that psychoanalysis, like basically ever since Paul, you have a continuation of a kind of third testament, which is the working out of what is reality like? What are humans like? How do we figure out the best way to structure it? And how are these things circling it in different ways? And psychoanalysis ends up, well, describing the same human subjectivity that Paul is describing, right? He's talking about the same, I am, you know, I'm not what I am in any Iago sense that Paul's talking about. And psychoanalysis becomes an elucidation of it. And I think it can help the Christian understand why psychoanalysis is valuable if you understand that in Paul is a methodology, is a discourse that is still continual to this day. Paul is not so much writing dogmas. He's absolutely writing some principles in Romans. But what you see in Galatians and Corinthians is an elucidation of a discourse that is continual now, right? Now, you're still in the age of the Third Testament, if you will. And that would then show how Christianity can actually have much more overlay with the Jew, with the story between the rabbi at the beginning as is going on, because they have the discourse that's still going on. Well, guess what? The Third Testament is still going on as well, per se. That is the live discourse of what is happening right now.
I guess just real quick, what then would you say is the Second Testament in
the Gospel? The life of Jesus, would be Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. Yeah. And some people also will say the three synoptic gospels over the John, because John is later on. But there's some new work out of, say, Oxford and Cambridge that shows John is earlier than we thought. So the life of Jesus would be your Second Testament.
Okay. And just incarnation, all of that, what that all means.
Yes, and I would really emphasize with the Second Testament the historic episode, like the narrative itself, like the life of Jesus, like Ivan Illich really wants to emphasize. Not like the dogmas and like sort of notions, but like the actual sort of lived, well, there are principles, but they're the lived exercises. You know, the line between exercise and principle is a distinction that's important. But you see in the second, like the person of Jesus would be the Second Testament. And it also makes sense because then like three testaments also better overlays with the Trinity structure, right? You have the Father in the First Testament of the Torah. The second would be Jesus. The third would be the Holy Spirit. So it creates more of a Trinitarian structure as well.
What would you, okay, you said there's a distinction between the experience. Sorry, what did you say? The experience?
I said exercise and principle. Like Jesus is giving us a ton of exercise, but a lot of people are like, well, what are the teachings of Jesus as opposed to the life of Jesus?
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess I've always lately I've been thinking on that we a lot of times are obsessed with trying to understand his content, like the content of the things that he's teaching, but maybe sometimes like forget to also bring in like the form, the shape of his life, the movement of, if this was really God incarnate, that means that he was the highest who became the lowest and who had all of these guys following him around, calling him rabbi and teacher and elevating him all the time. And then at the very end of near the end, he's the one who gathers them together and says, you know, tonight like everything I've been teaching you, now I'm going to show you this. And tonight I'm washing your feet. And so I don't know if that ties into...
It ties in extremely well, because what you see, you know, Ivan Illich, who is excellent on this, he says, look what's always happening with Jesus. So the Pharisees and the Sadducees are like, hey, Jesus, what's the most important commandments? And he's like, you know, love your neighbor and set God as first. And like, okay, who's my neighbor? And Ivan Illich points out, he's like, what are they looking for? They're looking for a principle. They're looking for a dogma that they can say, my neighbor is X person, therefore that's who I'll love. And what does Jesus do? He tells a story. And the story first says that the Good Samaritan, the Samaritans are not friends of the Jews. That's why the woman at the well, she's like, hey, your kind don't talk to me. I'm a Samaritan, right? So it's almost like today Jesus telling a story about the good atheist. That's how like provocative it is.
Right.
And he's
right.
Like, you know, here's a Good Samaritan. And your neighbor is the one you just come upon. And this is the point of Ivan Illich. Your neighbor is the unexpected, the one you simply come upon and you didn't expect to come upon it. But it's also funny because the story actually blurs neighbor as the Samaritan and the person on the side of the road. Your neighbor is the Samaritans who hate you and they're good, and it's the guy on the side of the road. So Jesus does not give you a simple principle. He gives you a narrative that then you have to think about, engage in exegesis about, and come up. But the main thing that Ivan Illich says is that Jesus is always basically teaching you to be prepared for the unpreparable, for that which you don't expect to occur. And so what you see in Jesus, a way I put it, is someone who's really good at improvisation, someone who's extremely good at responding to whatever occurs, almost like a hip-hop artist, almost like a cypher, almost like an artist, like you're able to just respond, right? To be able to respond looks like magic, but it's due to a lot of conditioning. It's due to a lot of work, right? Why is the Good Samaritan able to take care of the man on the side? Because he has money, he has connections, he has the ability to take care of him. But he didn't know he would use his connections for that, but when it occurred, he's ready for it. So what you see in the person of Jesus is a preparedness for what cannot be prepared for, the unexpected, what comes upon you. Turns out God's going to wash your feet. Didn't see that one coming. He's always flipping the script like the hip-hop artist. The reason why this is important, though, is because this would suggest that Jesus is kind of like the Das Ding. The Das Ding cannot be systemized, right? It cannot be put into symbolic forms. Well, Jesus, in a way, is showing you the Das Ding, that God has a kind of Das Ding to them. It's like, oh, you thought you knew what God's going to do? Oh, you wanted to know what it was to be a Christian? It's to be ready for that which cannot be systemized. It's to be able to respond to the unexpected. Well, what is the unexpected? Jesus is like, I don't know, good luck. And then Paul's basically like, okay, the unexpected is Corin. The unexpected is nuclear exodus. The unexpected is AI. What does it mean to today be able to respond to that? So what you see in Paul is a response to what was not expected. And also, we always have to remember, Paul is writing letters to particular people in particular times. Did Paul know that 2023 America is going to be reading about his advice for the particular people in Corinth? No, he did not. He did not know his letters would be packaged together with the four Gospels and treated like a new Torah. He's writing letters to give basically advice to people that are in unprepared for situations, in the same way that we're reading Lacan going, I wasn't prepared to be an adult and have objects of desire I can never encounter. You're reading friggin' Bostrom, you know, with the super intelligence. I wasn't expecting this AI to take my job, right? It's like, what do I do? And you're going online, watching videos, looking for advice, trying to figure. All of the ideas you're looking for is figuring out how to respond to the unprepared. And what Jesus is showing is a model of someone who does not pull themselves out of life. Because basically, if you can have dogma, you don't have to participate. You just know how the world works, right? You have the law. You know what God wants you to do. Well, I don't have to be in the world because I'm actually kind of over it. Jesus won't allow that. You have to be in and prepared for the unprepared. But how do you prepare for something you don't know you're going to encounter? That's the trick. That's why you always have to be returning to, relying on the Holy Spirit, praying, opening, looking, aware, don't keep your eyes open, right? Because the wind will come and go, right? Because you have to have this, but that's how you avoid systemization. And what Ivan Illich, to close the point, Ivan Illich was so concerned with the church because he's like, what ended up happening is that the Catholic Church, because he's a Catholic, he's critiquing, it's like they have removed the conditioning for the unprepared and replaced it with dogma. And then what Ivan Illich says is the inversion principle. He says the best of things, when it is corrupted, becomes the worst of things, right? And so for him, the only way to understand the modern world is as a perverted Christianity. because it was the best of things that was made into the worst of things, which is to say that what we did was take Christianity and try to systemize it and turn it into a dogma. Well, once you do that, you get all of the 20th century for Ivan Illich. You get, you know, you could say some of the progressive projects, you could say capitalism. All of these have principles of Christianity that are then systemized in service of a power structure. And so for Ivan Illich, by basically saving Christianity is a matter of making it more like hip hop. Honestly, is to make it more improvisational. And I think you see that. And so what Jesus is putting forth is an ability to respond to the unprepared, which then makes Das Ding central in a way to the life of Jesus, because Das Ding is the endless source of what you cannot prepare for because it cannot be symbolized. The very reason you need to be like Jesus is because there is a Das Ding. There is a thing that can never be systemized. So Jesus becomes a model that then is actually embracing the reality of Das Ding in that sense.
Yeah. And what do you think of, I haven't read Richard Boothby's book yet on Embracing the Void, but I don't know if you have, but, you know, in a, I think in an interview with Todd McGowan, Todd kind of asked him sort of like, so do you think that it's, I take it that his problem with Paul is something along the lines of Paul sort of by that somehow we get this point where Paul there's like a, do you affirm confessionally XYZ? So belief becomes the thing that then others you from other people, as opposed to what Boothby, I think, is saying that Jesus is, you know, really teaching in loving the not only the neighbor but also the enemy, keeping yourself radically open to the Das Ding of the other. Do you know what I'm talking about? What Boothby's saying there with this, that when we make it about like affirming XYZ belief, then we can suddenly have insiders and outsiders.
I understand the argument. I think that gets us into very deep weeds of the project of election, justification, salvation, and what Paul is doing. Paul is absolutely saying that a Christian is someone who believes that Jesus was resurrected. But that doesn't actually equal salvation. This is what's destroyed American Protestantism, is the, we think the confession of belief equal salvation. For Paul, that just means you're now part of the Christian group, basically. It doesn't mean salvation. Because in Judaism, there is the things that make you a Jew. So for example, you have a Jewish mother, you do the ritual bath, there are certain things, and now you are part of Judaism, right? And for Paul, if the Jews are God's people, like these are God's people, that means if you don't have a Jewish mother, you basically can't be a Jew. And you also have to, you know, they obviously talk so much about, the different markings that people have to do that escapes me at this moment. Wow, this is, you know, I
know what you're talking about.
Wow, I can't figure it out. Wow, that's what happens when you don't have enough coffee. and so, like, that's a very high mark for people.
Yeah.
And Paul's, and they're like, well, then, you know, that's a problem. But actually, you can be part of God's people. You can basically become a Jew just by believing that Jesus is the Son of God and that he was resurrected. Because at that point you have to go, okay, well, if there is a difference between Christian and non-Christian, this is actually a problem we have to this very day, right? Like, what makes an American? Well, if you say X, Y, and Z, aren't you excluding people? Like, all definition excludes. Like, that's the problem. But if you have no definition, well, then you don't have identity. And this is all of belonging again. This is the whole tension, right? So what Paul is faced with is a question of how do you have identity as a Christian? Because then he's got all these people who are like, well, if, you know, grace abounds, we can do whatever we want, right? He's like, no, there is certain limitations on actions that make you Christ-like, but how do you not make that so onerous that you just go back to the law? So this is what Paul is navigating. In fact, Paul can be an extremely useful resource to engage in thinking pluralism. But people don't do that because they see Paul as setting down dogma as opposed to, I think N.T. Wright is correct, inventing theology. Paul is basically inventing theology, which is reasoning from theological axioms in situations that are not directly stated by the deity, and doing it in a manner that opens it up to people without closing it all. I think that Boothby is critiquing a Protestant interpretation of Paul that places Paul after Second Temple Judaism versus with First Temple Judaism, and not saying that Paul's primary concern in Romans is extending the terms of entering into being one of God's people to being very, very generous. All you have to do basically is believe that Jesus died for your sins. You're now a Christian. And that's pretty radical because, like, there's not much else. Like, you don't have to go through all that had to go. But what's also very critical, you do not see in Paul a notion of saved by faith alone. Like, this is not found in Paul. What you find is justification by faith alone, which means that the only criteria to being part of God's people is faith. Whereas before it was having a Jewish mother, going through certain things, and it was a higher bar, right? Now that doesn't mean that no one can become a Jew that isn't a Jew, it was just more difficult. So Paul greatly eased the requirements, actually. So what's kind of funny is a lot of people accuse Paul of creating these high bars that people have to pass to be Christian. Well, actually, relative to his day, Paul is lowering the bar dramatically because Paul did not know he wasn't going to be a Jew. Like, at this time, he's still part of the Jewish people, right? So, like, oh, you know, God's doing a new thing, and now there are many people that can be Jewish without having to have the same Christian. So in one way, it's actually a very liberating project. The issue becomes, if you read the gospel after basically the Enlightenment, where you're looking for principles after Descartes and you have a metaphysics that's not there, mainly soul, spirit, body, and you're looking for, whereas before the spirit is Rahi, R-A-H-I, which means the animating principle of the body, there is no separate spirit and soul. Like, once you read Paul through that lens, then you see a guy talking about saving the soul. You see a guy that's laying down dogma. You don't see him as engaged in live reasoning that he himself does not know is going to be treated as dogma. All he knows he's doing is helping people in friggin' Corinth. He doesn't know that Americans in 2023 are going to be looking for, like, hard, fast rules by which to live their lives. Paul is in the business of anything of guides, not rules. Now, there are, of course, some rules, because there's the rule of believing Jesus was resurrected if you're going to be a Christian. But is that a rule, or is it just a requirement for definition? Like, at that point, it's like saying it's a rule for the word cat to mean feline. I guess that's a rule, but that's just what's required for definition. So that's what I would say on Paul. I think you have to see him as doing something very different than what we tend to think he's doing after basically the Enlightenment, basically Cartesianism, basically scientific rationalism, basically after 200 years of dealing with religion that has an understanding of saved by faith as opposed to justified by faith, which then opens the entire question of, okay, well, if all we are is justified by faith, if being Christian is not, like, if that's like the bare minimum, that's all faith does is like make you justified by faith, well, then what do we do now? Well, I guess we have to do live reasoning because half the stuff we're dealing with today was not around back then. So that would be what I have to say on that.
Okay. And that maybe, so then maybe, I mean, would you say then that the live reasoning has to come out of a place that takes seriously some sort of a relational ontology?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes, because Jesus, and if God is love, there's a fundamental relation there. God is a creator. He's relating to something he creates. You have Jesus emphasizing, you know, community, disciples. There's the whole thing is structured with relation. Absolutely.
Love. Ah. Who knew? oh, man, Daniel, it's been so good to get to talk to you. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. Is there anything else that, you know, we didn't really touch on belonging again, but see, the thing is I haven't had a chance to really sit with and read through all of it. But I've, you know, gotten to listen to a lot of your talks. I've gotten to read various things. I was going to, you know, start off with asking about, you know, I think at the beginning you have this line that says we're all, these days we're, all condemned to be existentialists. And I thought that would be a great place to start, but hey, the real came in, and probably what I needed more than anything was to be able to kind of revolve around Christianity and psychoanalysis and how those things are fitting together. And it's funny how it always finds its way through.
Well, I've enjoyed it immensely, Tyler. And no, that's a wonderful quote from Peter Berger, because to me, that quote actually goes to speak why we have to think in terms of what Paul was doing. If we are all, if there are no sociological backgrounds of givens, because basically that's what Paul's faced, right? There are no givens of what it means to be Christian. You know, that's not given. Jesus did not really teach on how you interact with the Corinthians. It's not given. So Paul is alive, really, when there is not sociological givens. And he's thinking through life. He's kind of existential. He's like, okay, I want to be true to Judaism because I am a Jew, but then Jesus changed something. What do I do? Well, it's not given. And so he's very, very philosophical. I mean, Paul is constantly using Platonic, Aristotelian categories. He's constantly, that's what we have to do today, basically. Where there's no givens, you have to engage in thinking, and thinking is terrifying, of course. Because what happens to most of the early Christians? They get killed, they get martyred, they make mistakes, they're hated, they're rejected by their neighborhoods. Likewise, when you engage in trying to figure out a new background, there's a lot of rejection. There's a lot of feeling like, what am I even doing anyway? Maybe I'm crazy, that you have to engage with, because the loss of sociological givens isn't fundamentally an existential situation that has to be thought through. And anxiety always creates thinking, of course, because when you're anxious, you're thinking, why am I anxious and what am I doing with my life? So to me, one of the reasons why I've appreciated this conversation, I'd love to do it again, is because it helps so much, I think, especially for the Christian, once you, like, in a pluralistic world that Christians know they're in today, you look at the Bible and you go, none of this speaks to my situation. Wait a minute, actually, if Paul is a third testament, it does. And if you think of Paul as putting forth a methodology, as inventing the thought and movement of theology and giving you epistemological revelations on how to think, then you can actually see that, no, this present moment is not something, it's different, of course, they didn't have internet, but it is not radically different from what Paul was facing, because he was fundamentally facing a way of thinking when it is not given how one should think, or God is doing a new thing, and what in the world is God doing? We never knew he would do this. Likewise, we never knew that the givens would collapse. We never knew about AI. We never knew about economics. We never knew about these things. Well, then you have a friend in Paul. You have someone to find solidarity with and to think through. And again, the other thing we just got to keep in mind, I think we all imagine Paul, if we were like talking about our thinking of what we should do with nuclear ethics, I think we have this image in our mind of Paul going, no, 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 this is what it says in Romans, do that. That's our image. That's not what he would do. You put it perfectly in your story at the beginning. He's a Jew. He would have had a conversation with you. Paul is not this. We have this vision of Paul as this kind of legal judge, because we use the language of justification. We have courtroom metaphor. So we have this idea of Paul going, no, 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 no. That's not what Jews did. Jews sat on a bench and had a debate about the law. And then when God showed up to tell them what to think, they're like, well, what are you doing here? So Paul can be a much more graceful individual than we realize if we just know that there's a conversation to be had with him. And that's what I think we need to think today, to engage in the solidarity with Paul, to see a third testament that we are participating in now, and thinking through and trying to be true to that discourse and that conversation matters. And so I've appreciated the chance to share it with you.
Oh, thank you so much. And yeah, I'd love to do this again. I think I probably need to go back and listen to everything that you've said, and then I'll start to have more questions, and I'll probably reach out some more, and just, you know, getting to tune in and listen to what you guys are doing on a regular basis always is, I'm sure, going to spur on new questions on my end. So thank you so much.
Well, I've appreciated it, Tyler. Thank you so much. I look forward to it. Thank you for your time, sir.
Okay, everybody, thanks for listening, and please check out OG Rose on YouTube, Medium, Spotify, or whatever podcast app that you use. Just type in OG Rose. You'll probably be able to find him. Belonging Again is the name of the book, and that can be found on Amazon. And here's a little bonus content for you, brought to you by The Real.
Oh, nope, I'm lost again. No, it's just me. Well, maybe I should, like, sing or something. Alas, I could do a song and dance routine. I actually do need the harmonica. Do I even have it? Oh yeah, here we go. Is it gonna work? See, I'll do this. Thank you.